Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema. As part of our celebration of Hispanic Heritage Month, we'll hear two discussions which took place following screenings of the films Orfeo Negro, Black Orpheus, directed by Marcel Camus, and La Historia Oficial, The Official Story, directed by Luis Puenzo. The first film, produced in France and Brazil in 1959, is set in the favelas and streets of Rio de Janeiro amidst its poor residents and black majority. Even though Black Orpheus finds an important source in the Greek myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, it is largely based on a play by Vinicius de Moraes. The second film, produced in Argentina in 1985, tells the story of Alicia, a high school history teacher in Buenos Aires in 1983, after the fall of the military junta, which had taken over the government since 1976. She and her husband, Roberto, have a 5-year-old adopted daughter, Gabby. Alicia is ignorant of what happened during the coup until her students begin to ask her if she believes all that the official history books say about the matter. She begins to wonder if her daughter might be one of the children of the disappeared. Both of these films, part of Filmstream's Cinemateca series, won Academy Awards as Best Foreign Language Films of their respective years. The members of the first discussion are Maria Arbeláez, Associate Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and Omowale Akintunde, Chairman of the UNO Black Studies Department. This part of the program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 2nd, 2008, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, the University of Nebraska at Omaha, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce this part of the program is Maria Arbeláez.
Tonight's feature is Orfeo Negro, or Black Orpheus, based on the myth Greek between Orpheus and Eurydice, but I'm not going to say anything about the theme, but I want you to, because it's an innovative thing about this, it's not the retelling of the myth, that it is set amongst the carnival, the Brazilian carnival. And the Brazilian carnival, as probably you know, it's an event that it has been actually recreated through every year for centuries by the Brazilians, that basically the working classes, the ones that live in the favelas, because the carnival is a favela event, that is the barrios, that is the Villas Miseria, or the, you know, these marginal towns that they were, you know, sprung around the cities, but it is an event, and they live and die for carnival. And the other aspect about it is about the samba. You have to listen to the samba and the existence of the baianas. There's a third one, and even it is the macumba, one of the traditional religions in Brazil.
You want to say something, Wally?
Well, actually, I do, because it was a double pleasure for me. Just to give you a little background, I just finished film school. And I just got here from L.A., so I'm a filmmaker myself, and I look at movies totally differently now than I used to. And I think there were two things that really struck me. And, you know, as a cinematic entity, I was really impressed just by the visuals of the film, the use of color and the use of music to support what was happening visually. And the thing that struck me secondarily was the use of visual metaphor. And I would like to ask the audience, what kinds of cinematic metaphors did you see throughout the film that correlated with either the original Greek or just something that just stuck out for you throughout the film in terms of metaphor?
The names of the two people, Orpheus, and I can't pronounce her name, but they were from Greek. Were they from Greek?
It's Greek mythology.
Yeah,
yes.
And I just didn't know the mythology. I sort of did, and I think.
Okay, let's make it simple. Orpheus loved Eurydice, but it was a. You see, in all this Greek cosmology, it was a fatal love. She died, and she went to Hades. You know, that's like the other world, the underworld. And actually, Cerberus, you saw the dog, right? It's at the gate of the of the underworld. And he was told that Hermes is the messenger of the gods, and he was told that he could recover Eurydice, but that she would follow him on her way back to Earth, but he couldn't look back.
and otherwise he wouldn't get her. So, but he looked back, he couldn't resist temptation. And so there's a lot of metaphor, there's a lot of allegory as well, because it's death. You know, and in this Greek philosophy, that's actually we are destined to die. So there is the death, and our destiny, it's inescapable. We cannot fool fate, right? We are going to be doomed anyway. That's exactly what's a metaphor in there.
It's amazing how when you see something as a child and then you watch it as an adult and you're looking at it through different lens as metaphor and resurgence of Greek mythology, it has an entirely different set of meanings for you. Yeah.
Talking about the descent into Hades, that where they're in the building, and that's like his descent into hell.
Yeah. Yes.
It's read down at the bottom, and you just see him taking that descent down.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to comment on that because I was kind of, I think I was trying to write in the dark, but I think I wrote something to the effect that, you know, story transcends time and everything else, because I'm sure when you watched it as a child, it played very well just as a dramatic entity. But it's amazing how they were able to use a 1950 setting within that context and tell a story that was, God, how old?
Timeless.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, thousands of years.
Yeah, just transcends culture and time.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. At least, what is it, 22,000 years?
Yeah.
More or less.
Yes, we have another question down front.
I guess I was interested in the part where, at the end, where the young boy becomes Orpheus, and I was thinking reincarnation in a sense with that. And I don't know what that was supposed to symbolize or if it symbolized that or not.
Well, you can interpret that, but also you can interpret that in spite that we are doomed, that our fate is to die, there is still another day. And we have to make the best of it, right? You know, the sun will always rise, whether we're here or not. It will rise, yeah. But we are nominated. It has nothing to with the reincarnation. What's interesting is the shift here from all this mythology to candomblé. That's the rituals that we saw. This candomblé, it's one of the Afro-Brazilian religions, and it's recognized as a religion together with Macumba. And you saw all the, you know, the orishas, the avocations of the spirits of the gods. You know, you saw Saint Francis, the Virgin Mary, you know, San Lázaro, and everybody else. But because that's the form that they took to avoid persecution, and it is part of Brazilian spirit. All this religiousness, it is part of that spirit in the same way that it's the music.
And I wondered why the man that was following her didn't kill her, or, I mean, it's obvious, but, you know.
You're referring to death?
Yeah.
Yes.
Why wouldn't they kill her? Because he was going to have it anyway. She was going to die. And that's about the, that we are, you see, the Greeks are saying that we have, that our destiny, it's inescapable, and our destiny is to die. We cannot do anything. We are not immortal. Immortal work the gods. But we are going to die, and that's our destiny. We do everything. Still, the sun will rise, but we are going to die.
But I think you pose a good question, because if I'm following you, if death is an inevitability, then why is death there chasing as if you could elude it? Is that where you were going? Because I found that kind of interesting too, and also with the child, because throughout the film, there's this young boy that's chasing and following as if you're trying to escape, but there's this youthful quality that's suggesting that it will always be there to take its place. Or
yes, but actually it's that life goes on regardless of the inevitability of death, that we're going to die anyway. And that our destiny, it's there. It's all set off. You know, it's already written. You know, wherever it's written, in the skies, on the earth, whenever. And that we cannot escape. That's about the Greek philosophy and all these myths, that regardless of what we do, we have to live our destiny. And this children, what is fascinating about this child is there's two. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it is that the belief that that the sun had to rise, because otherwise there's going to be no continuity of life. Mm-hmm. And that's very, and that is part actually of the, let's say, the American indigenous spirit. You have to remember that that all these sacrifices and all these rituals of the indigenous population of the Americas for the sun, that the sun had to come out, that it was going to come out. And, you know, all sacrifices had to be done, and the woman would have to accompany me during the night and the warriors during the day, because it has to come. You cannot understand life. You don't understand, you know, the cycle of the sun. And these children, that's actually what they say. They have, you have to continue this. You know, you have to play the guitar because the sun won't come out. Won't be alive.
Well, you know, I had another question for the audience, because earlier you alluded to this story being a couple thousand years old, at least. Is anyone in the audience aware of that story being even older than that, rather than being rooted in a Eurocentric mythology? Does anyone know its correlation to ancient Kemet? Because that story dates back even farther than the European manifestation of it as a story of death and the inevitability of it and the rising of youth. Is anyone familiar with any stories that come out of ancient Egypt or Kemet that's very similar?
You see, not exactly as this mythology, but for instance, this cult of the sun related to life. Mm-hmm. You say you can find it in Egypt, you can find it in Mesoamerica, you can find it almost everywhere.
Right, I know, but I'm just saying it's interesting that it's set within this Greek mythology, which causes us to think that is the origin of the story, but it's a much older story than even a couple thousand years. If you kind of pointed to this whole Afro-Brazilian manifestation of it too. And I thought, what about the technical part of that? Again, the filmmaker part is coming out of me, the child actors in that film. And does anyone
how about the child actors?
Yeah.
You know, Brazil is very famous for this, because they were not actors. In reality, they're people from the favelas.
Okay.
And that's you can see it's a and this child who plays the La Pandereta, he became a very famous dancer and player of the pandero.
Oh, because I wondered.
He did. He became very, very famous. But he came out, all these people come out of the favelas. These are, you know, these marginal on this side. And actually, there's a constant allusion to these two worlds that you have there. You know, like you have the sun, you know, and during the day and the night, you know, the night, because you have all constantly this reference, you know, to that under where that is all these beautiful buildings, but that is Rio, you know, and all this marginality and this poverty, but to living for a carnival.
Right.
But you know, it's really afar, it's distant, it's, you know, but still beautiful, but it's a reality that it's afar from it.
Great. Yes, right here. And I see another hand. Somebody has the mic back here already. We'll come back down.
My question is more about, I guess, the filmmaker. I read earlier today, I think it was on IMDb, that this film, unfortunately, has been discounted by critics because Camus' work after this film was of relatively poor quality. Is that consistent with what you know of the history of this film? Or, is it unfortunately kind of overlooked because of his poor work afterwards? Or
I don't know. I know it won the Palme d'Or, which is the top prize at Cannes, and it also won an Academy Award. And of course, there aren't any higher honors that you can, you know, bestow upon a film than those two major ones. I'm not familiar with his work afterwards or the impact
Yes, and he's right. That's a note. And it's like any movie, you know, become a classic. Is or the author is just one book.
Yeah.
Or the one, that's it.
You get one masterpiece a lifetime, and that's it, okay? So choose well.
And actually, the whole is that Camus was able to work with Vinicio de Moraes, Bonfa, and these are people who were, you know, in the right to in on their way to writing these magnificent songs. And actually, Vinicio de Moraes, and you know, but he's very famous later on as a songwriter. But he adapted the myth to the Brazilian reality, to the favela reality, and. Because Vinicio de Moraes is very well known for samba and bossa nova, and one of these it's that he wrote
they
the Girls from Ipanema
movement, right? As a result of the film, is that not correct?
Yes.
Yeah.
But actually, what is interesting is that Camille never was able to produce another quality film like this one. So this became the classic. There is a remake or Black Orpheus, and but it's let's say that it's less allegorical. And actually, probably Camus, he didn't intend it, you know, to do these things that just happened during the movie making. But the Black Orpheus, the new version of the Black Orpheus, let's say it's much more political in the respect, because you see, this is, you can see that it is all the way in the background. It's there no reference, no direct reference to politics or to social conflict. And actually, there's a great deal of social conflict in Brazil, especially in Rio this time, because you have the rise of the cities, but at the same, you have the rise of poverty and discrimination and social injustice.
This might end up being a little long-winded question, so I'll preface it with that. I was just curious if you thought there was some significance behind the names of, besides the Greek names, for example, Chico standing for, you know, they kind of reiterate repeatedly, you know, he's this stupid boy. If they're making a point that, you know, Chico represents, you know, males in general, also with the name Benedito, and he's always following Orpheus around. So I was wondering if there's any sort of significance behind, you know, Benedito being probably Benedict in English and Benedict being, you know, a rather famous Catholic saint, if there's any significance between those.
No, there is no direct allusion. These are very common names in Brazil. And actually, Chico, it's a small, but it's Chico, it's like a guy, like a friend, like a pal to Chico. Okay, and it's used constantly. Yeah. No, there is no reference, and there's no second entendre there that I think.
But. Yeah, but I'd like to interject that that's a good point, because I'm one of those people who thinks there's an underlying meaning in everything, and I think that sometimes maybe there's not an intentional. motion to give something, you know, meaning underneath, but it can. There's this whole epistemological domain that's always functioning, that's always informing our sense of knowing. So even sometimes the artist is not aware of it. It's like, you know, my thesis film, I showed it, and it was amazing to me what the audience saw in the film. And I was like, I didn't put that in there, but they saw all this deep, you know, secondary meaning and metaphor. And I was like, no, that's just what my mama said one day when we were. But, you know, I concurred that it was very deep and metaphorical, because it just sounded right. So I'm not really sure I would dismiss it as absent. I think that sometimes meaning is there, even if the creator, the artist herself or himself, didn't intend it.
How was the film received in Brazil when it came out?
And other
countries, was it?
Oh, actually, it was perceived very well. First of all, because it was filmed, but, you know, some of the actors, they were professional actors. Because it was a very Brazilian theme. You know, it's about poverty, about marginality, about carnival, about love, about the beauty of samba, about the beauty of their environment. But everybody, it represented Brazil, because it is 60% of Brazilians are blacks and mulattoes. And that's Brazilian population. And that's a Brazilian reality. Mm-hmm. So yeah. that's part of it. You know, they were seeing themselves in the movies.
Was it a very popular movie?
Oh, it was a popular movie. Yes, it was, especially because you are guaranteed to have an audience and public if you have Vinicio de Moraes, and he knows a scriptwriter and a musician, or you have Bonfá. Mm-hmm. Right, it's a guarantee in Brazil.
Yeah, and to address your question about how was it received, you know, universally, I would think that the fact that it won the top prize at Cannes, where you have filmmakers that are coming from all around the world deciding that this particular film is the most emblematic and representative of cinematic excellence, is probably an indication that universally it was probably well received and people saw its worth and value across cultures.
You've been listening to a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 1959 French and Brazilian film Black Orpheus, directed by Marcel Camus. The members of the panel were Maria Arbeláez, Associate Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and Omawale Akintunde, Chairman of the UNO Black Studies Department. The discussion took place at Filmstreams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema. Our program will continue now with the discussion which followed our second film, La Historia Oficial, The Official Story, directed by Luis Puenzo. This discussion was led by Claudia Garcia of the UNO Office of Latino and Latin American Studies, which co-sponsored the series along with UNO Professor Sam Walker. This part of the program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 9th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Here now to continue the program is Claudia Garcia.
In this movie, the story of a woman is also the story of a country, so you need a little bit of information to just follow the movie along better, I think. And that piece of information is, of course, the dictatorship in Argentina that started in 1976, ended in 1983, and what we call La Guerra Sucia, the dirty war, the terrorism of a state. Actually, although we tend to concentrate the idea of Guerra Sucia associated with the dictatorship, it had started before the dictatorship in the last constitutional government, and its effects continued to last even after the return of democracy, which is part of what makes this movie not history, not historia oficial or no, but still something pretty much that pertains to the present. So the key of the thing is just the appropriation of babies who were, kidnapped with their parents or born in captivity and then given to families who were sympathizers of the regime. Now, just to let you know how present and current and still non-history this is, today the abuelas de Plaza de Mayo, grandmothers of Plaza de Mayo, have announced the recovery of two more sons of children of the disappeared, who are now 31 and 28. So this is part of what we are going through. The military is still being judged. Those children are still being recovered. And so this time is usually thought for just questions and answers, and I'll be glad to take any questions you have, and hopefully I'll be able to answer those. Yes.
Was this period in Argentina under the dictatorship of one person, or was this the period of the general or the colonels?
The dictatorship in Argentina took the form of several juntas. So juntas were just three people, one person from each one of the forces, and so we had actually like three or four of them. And that was precisely what I wanted to say, that this is actually, it was March 1983. This is the end of the period. So that's why we see what we see, because, of course, 1976, would have never been possible. So 1983, this is after the Malvinas War, which the military lost, in 1982. That was, there was a moment when the military thought that the situation in the country was chaotic, the crisis was terrible, there was more and more pressure, and the military felt that they had to do something huge just to reinforce the feelings of patriotism and that they were there for some good reason. And that's when they decided to re-invade or re-try to get back the Malvinas, which historically belongs to Argentina, but the British had taken over. So this was like the big thing that was supposed to congregate all the popular will behind the military. And the war was a disaster, so the military lost the war. The people who were killed in the war were just soldiers, 18-year-olds who had practically no training, and officers were back there just enjoying good food. So after that was really the collapse, and the situation couldn't hold any longer. So really, this is the moment when they have lost all the backing. People in Argentina could not back the military anymore, And this is the moment in which they decide to orchestrate the transition. But they are still powerful because that's the truth. You know, it's like they...
One of us.
Yeah.
And also, I got from the movie, but maybe this is not true, was the church complicit in these...
Yes.
Oh, I guess I opened that can of worms,
just
didn't
like,
I?
unfortunately, the church was completely together with the military. And as a matter of fact, not long ago, finally, in October 2007, one of these big priests that was un capellán del ejército, so he was there. He was judged and condemned as a genocide. You know, this was part of the general ideology that they were trying to impose, and that's the idea that they believed that they were rescuing these people, both the military and the church, that they were doing torturing and killing people, making people disappear, so that all the subversivos, all the terroristas, all the communism, international Marxism, those were the words, was going to be wiped out. And so, and this is the underlying logic, also, to just kidnapping kids and or even, you know, like pregnant women, when they were made disappear, when they were taken to centers of detention, they were assigned a much better diet, so they were kept as healthy as possible until they delivered their babies, because those babies were then taken, given to someone else, and the idea was these babies are going to be brought up in decent homes with the right ideology, so on and so forth. And this is part of what, I mean, they say, this is what the priest tells Alicia when she's confessing. She says, like, don't reject what God has given you, because you are giving this child a good home, so he has this double... He actually knows who was the little girl's mother. So it's pretty tough.
It is interesting to be able to compare the Chilean case with the Argentinian case. In the Chilean case, there are very, very many similarities. However, the church was the only refuge that people had for 17 years. That is a big difference with Argentina.
Yes.
Now, also in the Chilean case, we were able to take Pinochet and many other generals to trial. What is the case in Argentina on that matter?
Well, that was that has been a process. So there was a first moment when democracy started, when Alfonsín took over, was a moment of big hopes for everybody. We really expected things to start all over again. Just what democracy implied was so huge. And he had promised that there was going to be a trial for the military. So, and it did happen, but it never had the magnitude that everybody expected. To start out with, there was the creation of a commission that investigated the truth, and the commission was not formed within the parliament, so they didn't have the means of subpoenaing anybody, so this was an independent commission. So very quickly we could see that Alfonsín and the democracy was reacting to other powers that were putting pressure. So what could actually be done was much less than justice. And so the second thing that happened was that Alfonsín made very clear that it was not that all the military and all the repressors, because to make 30,000 people disappear, this is not done by 3 or 6 or even 9 people. This is done by... Actually, it was done by hundreds and hundreds, and not just the military, but people like Roberto. It's the whole society. There was layers and layers of civil society, people who were just collaborating, lawyers, doctors, not just the priests, many, many, many people. And so what Alfonsín said, just to keep things calm and always with the ghost that the military could come back any time was to create the notion of due obedience. So the idea was that only the heads were going to be judged because they had given the orders, and so they were the only responsible ones. All the other ones that were underneath were in all the other ranks were not going to be judged, and so that limited very, very much how many of them. There were also legal pressures, and so they included not just those who had given the orders, but also those who had committed aberrant crimes, horrible crimes, crímenes aberrantes. But the truth is that was a great limitation. And then something else that happened was that when they started to be tried, there was something else that was called la ley del punto final. So there was this moment when they said, well, okay, 60 more days, it's the time anybody has to file more complaints. After that, punto final in Espanol is like period, nothing else. And so that was the end of it. And so they were judged. And what they received, it was just, you know, it's, I think Videla got a prison for life, and only to Videla y Macera, and one of them was only given 4.5 years, and then the thing was but they never actually were never in prison, in real prison. They were in this, just at home or the special prisons, and so on and so forth. And to make matters even worse, after a few years, during the presidency of Menem, they were pardoned. There was an amnesty, and so everybody went back home. All those repressors were back home in freedom, and so we had to wait a few years until that was annulled. And actually, the mothers of Plaza de Mayo and lawyers, Centro de Estudios Legales y Sociales, they found a way to actually bring military to justice just because of kidnapping kids and what had happened, because they had been judged for other things, and they found that there was a legal possibility of bringing them to justice because of that, and so that was a good thing. And some of them are in prison now, but it's those sorts of prisons, you know. I think there was another question back there. Yes.
My question is, said the priest was convicted in 2007. Do you still have problems or issues with people? Do you still have a lot of aftermath from this war now, today, or is everything solved?
Well, yes. As I was saying, this goes on, and just the military are trying. I mean, actually, it was in August that Luciano Benjamin Menéndez, Ibusi, those like huge repressors in the interior of the country. You know, the country during the dictatorship was divided up in like zones, sub-zones, and so they had a very complicated system so that there were always military heads there directing and the repression. And so those two assassins, genocides, were brought to justice and were judged and just condemned, I mean, less than a fortnight ago. So this is going on, and not just that, because there was the process of bringing these people to justice was very painful and very long, and not, I wouldn't say successful, not very successful, but what was successful in a way was the movement of human rights. What Madres de Plaza de Mayo started, what Abuelas de Plaza de Mayo also started. Madres de Plaza de Mayo got together for the first time in April 1977, and Abuelas got together in October of that same year. And so that movement grew, and there was also resonated with the international human rights movement. So this is something that has been happening, not just inside Argentina or inside Chile, but also abroad. And so there has been laws, international laws passed, and then later on accepted and ratified in the Argentine Constitution in 1994. And this has also allowed to bring some of those repressors to justice. So it's a very dynamic process. It's not what we would want, but it's not as bad, because what comes from this is that there is the possibility of bringing change, even when you have repression, even when you have terror, even when you have all the negative conditions imposed from above. If people get together and do something, something can be done. And then something that's, for me, it's moving. There's another organization that's called Hijos, which is actually, it's Hijos por la Identidad y la Justicia en contra del Olvido y del Silencio. But that is actually those children who have realized and have recognized, recovered their identity, and many others who support them, who have created their own association. And they, during a period when justice was absolutely impossible, they created something which is called Escrache, and they continue to be there. So their slogan was, their motto was, si no hay justicia, hay Escrache. Escrache is a slang word that means just to denounce, to just say something, show something you know that's bad about someone. And so they tried to find where these repressors, you know, like, not the big faces, just the lower faces, all the people that had been repressing others, identify where they were, in what area in the city, just investigate, talk to the, they would just work like for a couple months before orchestrating the real Escrache, make pictures, talk to the neighbors, and so finally one day come with placards and numbers of pictures, and they even created little chants, and so they just shamed the repressor in their own environment. And so this is good. I think it's good.
Yeah, I don't have any question, because I lived that time. I was a refugee. I'm from Buenos Aires, Argentina. I lived the torture. I spent 2 years in Rawson, in the United Nations, and the Human Rights Commission and Amnesty International. They took me out of Rawson after 2 years. And I reunited with my son. I had to send my son almost 900 kilometers, I think so, south of Buenos Aires, in a town is called Junín de los Andes. I sent my son there because they were adopted, taking the children from the prisoners. It was the Catholic Church and the military. I know what was the torture in prison, what the ladies say in the movie, Picanier. I know the word Picanier is torture, electricity in the genital, the water, what is called now the water border by the Bush administration. That's legal, according to them. I know how it's that. Well, I lived a time, and I'm proud. That is all.
Thank you.
Aquí.
Sí.
I would like to know how the press was subdued and if many of those desaparecidos were members of the press.
How the press was subdued?
By the government, yes.
Well, there was censorship. Like about 150 journalists were killed and made missing. So that's the way. I mean, there were still people saying things, but it was very difficult. You were risking your life at every step. So there's not only censorship that was going on, but also the just propaganda under pressure. So if you have a look at the ads that were shown by TV and on the radio, you know, it's like a complete brainwash. You had all those, you can find them on YouTube, you know, it's like, it's incredible. It's like, but it was all the time. And certain motives that just became ingrained, like, for instance, el silencio es salud, you know, it's like, silence is healthy. And that was, we had a huge sign, you know, el obelisco, which is a very important monument in Buenos Aires, it had a huge sign all around it that said el silencio es salud. So that's part of the idea and the ideology that was just being broadcast all the time.
Yeah. What you just said reminded me of loose, we were told loose lips sink ships, you know, during the World War II. Back to the film, and I was just really wondering what was going on in her classroom with those high school boys. And what you were just, and what they put on the board.
Yes.
And then what you were just saying about those the young people's organization and putting the truth before people.
No, that was different. That was different because what I was saying about young people, this movement Hijos started about in the 90s because when those little children like Gabby was, when they grew up and started to find out who they were, and out of 500 children, only 93 have been actually recovered. So that gives you an idea that although there are very good things and things that are positive, still, one has to wonder if what the idea the military had when they kidnapped and gave them away and robbed them, I mean, hasn't succeeded. Mm-hmm. No, what you could see what they were putting on the board on the blackboard, on the board, is just in Argentina you can have a paid ad. Usually, it's not a paid ad for advertising anything, but just to express. We also have that here in the States, but we call them solicitadas in Argentina. And so those were just maybe paid ads with pictures, some that you could see as pictures of all the missing people. Mm-hmm. So it was like ways of denouncing. Actually, one of the founder mother of Madres de Plaza de Mayo, Azucena Villaflor de Vicente, she was kidnapped and made disappear. Can't remember if it was 77 or 78, but very, very soon, actually the day they had published one of these solicitadas. So, and that is what Chris was saying before. You know, the press was censored, and even just publishing one of these ads was an act of disobedience, of defiance, and you could pay with your own life for that. But at the same time, it was the only way of making something known, yes.
I was just struggling with what significance that had, and if some of the young men in the room knew something and weren't part of the bourgeois,
yes,
and were trying to prick her conscience or suspected something.
Exactly.
I was struggling with that whole...
Exactly. And also that's part of the irony of the movie in a way, because, I mean, in 1983... only someone who really wanted to be blind, more than blind, like Alicia is, and someone who belonged to the upper classes and who was actually part of all that, could not be aware of what had been going on. You know, if this, I mean, I remember in 1977, 1978, I remember my parents, who had no connections with politics or whatsoever, they said, it's like, is it possible these campaigns, they had gone to Europe and they had seen some ads and they were thinking, is it possible? It was like, it was so preposterous that normal people that had not that many connections with politics were incredulous. But the presence of the Madres was very powerful, because I remember the day my mom was saying she had gone to Plaza de Mayo just by accident and seen these women. You know, they started going round and round and round because there was a state of siege. And so under a state of siege, you are not allowed to form groups, to be together in groups. And so they were a bunch of them. There were 14 of them. But the the policemen that were there said, you cannot stay here like that. You have to circulate. And so they could only be in pairs, because even three is already a group. So if you're under a state of siege, you can't be three, but you can be two. And so they were not making a demonstration of any kind. They were walking around the pyramid. And so that's the idea. And that's Eva de Bonafini, one of the mothers, says, rejects the idea. I don't want to be, I mean, that we did una ronda, ir en ronda. They were doing what the only way in which they could stay in the Plaza de Mayo and make themselves known and heard and seen was just...
And then even, it was very poignant in Alicia's and Roberto's family that even the families were torn.
Exactly.
Because they had people in their own families with conscience, and they were ashamed of Roberto, and that was very... I told you there were a lot of people like
and
that.
And I'm so glad that you're mentioning that, because it's a great connection with other movies in this series, because you can see that Roberto's dad is Spanish, and he has been a Republican, a socialist in the Spanish Civil War. So here there is a connection with those ideals and the reasons why the Republicans fought the Civil War, and the reasons why all these people were being killed in Argentina. And also, when this movie was made, you know, the little girl was threatened. They had, you know, the shooting started in 1982, 83, and there was a moment when they had to actually stop, pretend they were not shooting anymore. So the military, they were still powerful, you know. So you have, and so that's why, in a way, you don't see any uniforms in the movie. You don't see very overt, explicit thing. I mean, it's quite clear, obviously, but it's not that explicit. And so having Roberto's dad represent all these ethic values, the continuity of something that's morally solid and who's speaking out for the oppression, is a way, an indirect way of somehow validating the people who had died and what they had died for. Yeah. Yes.
I was interested in trying to understand what they were studying in that history class, because that was supposedly in 1810, but yet the violence and the cover-ups and the way it was reported, it to me could have been talking about the time that the movie was taking place. So could you clarify that?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. They were talking about the beginnings of the, you know, in 1810, that is when Argentina, in theory, declared its, in a way, its independence. It's a little bit more complicated than just that. It has to do with a number of things. But it's going back to a foundational moment in the history of the nation. And there's also a little thing, you see, did you perceive at the beginning, the opening scene, that everybody is there under the rain with the umbrellas? Well, the day when this big thing was declared, El 25 de Mayo, the foundational moment, is also reported to be a day under the rain. So what you were taught in primary school is that all the painters were there in the plaza under the rain, and they just were wanting to be independent, wanting to be a nation. And so what she is actually, and you have that in the opening scene, and what she is actually talking about and explaining is all the process in that primera, and actually the first form the Argentine government took was also una junta, la primera junta de gobierno. This was a junta not of three people, it was a junta of like 10 people, and there were military and there were progressives. And so what she's reporting on all their discussion is about the most progressive elements in that first junta, the ones who were killed, and the other ones, the conservatives, Saavedra, the ones who succeeded. So that's the connection between that foundational moment and this other junta of the dictatorship. Yeah.
If we continue the theme of the classroom for a second,
yes.
I'm interested in the relationship between the two teachers. not really the romantic tension so much as the fact that the male teacher seemed to be pushing a little bit the main character to explore more, to think more about what was going on. Academic freedom is so important for teachers, and I was wondering if you could talk about the impact of the juntas on academic freedom for the teachers. How similar was that to the role of the military on the press?
It was just terrible. You know, it's like it was my fate to be a teenager, to be one of them at that time, and also the great privilege. I think I started university under the dictatorship, and in the middle of that, democracy came. So I could actually experience the difference, and it was a very repressive. Let me talk about my high school experience, which is what you see there. It was a very, very repressive environment. And so when I look back, I can obviously see the differences in those teachers. So some were very extremely repressive. Some were trying to say things that I can see now. They were just opening up a little bit. You know, my history teacher in third year, which is when you study in depth Argentine history, this was 1977. And he mentioned in class, and now I understand that he did something really courageous, that he had been a Peronista and he was a revisionist, you know, and during Peronismo there was, Peronismo is the previous political movement, there was a very important group of historians that were precisely trying to revisit official history, the title of this movie. And so they had a different reading of history. And his classes, he were fascinating to me because he would just say things that you could not find on the books. And that in that context, I know that he was doing something much more daring than one would have expected. Another exception, a teacher who asked us to force us to read the papers. Every week we had to read the paper and select the most important news. This is extraordinary. And that was 1979. So you can see that they could do little things like that. But otherwise it was just, we were welcome at the entrance, and there were janitors. You were being watched all the time. And at the university, you know, it's like, of course I was in Philosophie y Letras, which is one of the places where the most subversives had been, you know, been caught. And so it was, I mean, there was really nothing you could study, you know, like everything was, it was somehow become, they made it neutral. And the philosophy classes were just, it was very Santo Tomé de Aquino. It was like just the fathers of the church. That's what you studied in a very repressive environment.
It occurs to me that while you're talking, it's, and this isn't really a question, just a comment, that it's wonderful that you're here and this film is shown and people are interested in it, because people in the United States are so egocentric that they're often not aware of some of the stuff that's going on in the rest of the world. So thanks for this.
Well, thank you.
One more person that wanted to talk.
Sure.
What form is the government at this point?
What form?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are in theory a democracy, and it is a democracy. But it's democracies as they are, they have been in this decades. You know, it's like I think we should rethink about the concept of democracy and what we mean and what it means to people. So. Difficult situations, but we went through a very, very hard, terrible crisis in 2001. Things improved, and so that's what it is. And it's, you can see all the sectors in tension But at least in the worst of the crisis, there was not the idea that the military were going to step up and save La Patria once again. So that's good. And the budget, military budgets have been cut, so there's no more forced, no more draft, you know, like all those kids who went to the Malvinas War, the Falkland Islands War, those were drafted, you know, it's like we don't have that anymore. So those are good signs.
I think this goes along with the gentleman's question of, it's kind of two parts. Are there still people that were involved with this in the government now? And how is history taught now? How are these stories taught now in Argentina?
Well, there has been important movements in terms of memory, you know, like the reconquering memory. This is very important and symbolic. One of the most important centers of detentions, La Escuela de Mecánica de la Armada, la ESMA, has been turned into a museum. And so it's a museum, El Museo de la Memoria. So that is very important. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't that. I mean, there was a moment that they wanted to just pull it down, create something else. So memory is a fight. And I think history is being revisited and reviewed all the time. And I think that at least the way in which history is taught has changed. So those are very good signs. You know, like I think that we always want more, and we want, because there is so much more that needs to be done. And yes, there is still people, you know, there's a reason why these assassins and criminals are not being judged more quickly, for instance. I mean, there could be things to be made so that if you have 1,000 criminals, you can judge them all the time, I mean, all at once before they all die of natural causes, you know. Well, that's not being done, but something is being done. So I think we need to preserve our balance and our sense of optimism, because without that, we cannot bring hope. Without hope, we cannot make anything change. And many things need to be changed, not just in Argentina, just everywhere. So that's the... We have to be critical and hopeful at the same time, which is not very easy, not a very easy balance.
Thank you so much. Yes, thank you, and thank you, Claudia.
You've been listening to a discussion which followed screenings of two films from the Cinemateca series presented by Filmstreams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema. The films were From France and Brazil in 1959, Orfeo Negro, Black Orpheus, directed by Marcel Camus, and from Argentina in 1985, La Historia Oficial, The Official Story, directed by Luis Puenzo. The members of the discussions were Maria Abreles, Associate Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, Omowale Akintunda, Chairman of the UNO Black Studies Department, and Claudia Garcia of the UNO Office of Latino and Latin American Studies. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evenings, September 2nd and 9th, 2008, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Laura Shainrock, and Jim Foyt of Filmstreams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Cinemateca series will continue at Filmstreams through October 2nd. Information on remaining films in the series is available at filmstreams.org. Complete Noon Forum listings are also available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.